And so now we are continuing to be dissecting the kingdom and examining its times and epochs. And the next time is the testing period, the Great Tribulation. We're going to look at that. And what I decided to do is, the way to look at it is, we're going to go through it in the book of Zechariah, the revolt in Zechariah. Because this is really what I love to do, is just take a book and go through the book. And I realize it's going to have to be a very kind of a skimming look at the book to go through 14 chapters in an hour. But I really love to do this, and this is how I've loved to study the Bible from way back. And really, when I started really, I told you I started reading the Bible when I was 13. I started reading Otis when I was 15. But after about 10 years of reading the Bible, it got to the point where I started to read a passage and say, oh yeah, you know, that's the kind of thing God does. That's the way he is. And realize that hold on, I'm really getting to know God. I'm willing to, I'm starting to read it many times before, but I'm saying, wait, I see the personality behind this. I see the person behind it. And I had slacked off a bit on my reading and realized I miss God. I can't slack off on my reading. I got to go back to this. And so it was through mostly just going through these passages and reading that I really started to really love God. You know, when you grow up with your parents are believers and you're going to church, you always say you love God. But it was through reading the Word that I really started doing it. So I love doing this, just going straight through. So what we're going to do is, some of the chapters aren't about the tribulation. I'm just going to give a real brief outline of those. And ones that have, I think, more to do with the tribulation period, I'm going to go a little bit more in depth. And if you want my complete in-depth study of the book, it's on my website. But we're looking at the book of Zechariah. Now, it's a book in the book in the Old Testament, or a book in the Old Testament at least, that is largely concerned with the revolt against the kingdom, especially in the later chapters of it. Just like Daniel, it's not exclusively about that. There's some about Daniel's day, and same thing in Zechariah. But it's kind of like Revelation is in the New Testament, just not completely focused on that. So we have, I'm going to give you three sections here, the early chapters, the middle chapters, and then we'll go most in-depth about the later chapters, because they're pretty much all about the tribulation period, I believe. But the early chapters are mostly dealing with Israel in the past. A little bit about the kingdom of God period, not really anything about the tribulation period yet. But in chapter 1, we have it about Zechariah's day. It says in verse 1, in the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet. So this gives us the time period. He's writing in the second year of Darius. Now, that's not the same Darius as Daniel, because Darius was just a title some of the Persian kings had. It meant the maintainer. So this was the later Darius, the one who was on the throne when they were building the temple, when they actually completed the project, I should say, not when they started it. So he's writing as the temple project has been put on hold for a while, and now it's going to be coming back online is when Zechariah is writing. So that's Zechariah's day. And the Lord is talking to them in Zechariah's day in these first few chapters here. And he is explaining what he wants the people to do. He wants them to turn back to him. Verse 11, it says, and they answered the angel of the Lord, stood among the myrtle trees, and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. And that's because largely the land hasn't been re-inhabited. In the captivity, Babylon had carried the inhabitants of Judah away into captivity, those that they didn't wipe out. And so the land was largely sitting empty. It was largely sitting at rest. In verse 12, it says, then the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 70 years, or these 70 years? So for 70 years, there has been indignation on the land. And he's saying, how long before you finally have mercy on them after these 70 years of indignation? Now, the Lord is going to have mercy, and he is indignant, in fact, not against them anymore, but now he's indignant against the nations who did these things to them. Verse 14, so the angel that communed with me said unto me, cry thou, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. And I am very sore displeased with the nations that are at ease. For I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. So he says, I wasn't nearly as displeased with my people as what these other nations poured out on them. So I'm angry, I'm indignant with them. And then verses 16 and 17, it's talking about the building of the temple. He wants the building project to start again. He says, therefore, thus saith the Lord, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith the Lord of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, my cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and the Lord shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem. So the temple is going to be built, and he says the other cities of Israel are also going to be restored. Well, of course, that happened in the past, but we realize even now we look forward to the complete restoration of the land in the kingdom of God. Now, in chapter 2, we have one maybe major departure from Zechariah's day and these first four chapters, and that we do kind of anticipate the kingdom of God in chapter 2. It is looking forward. And we see that especially in verses 4 through 5. Zechariah sees the angel that talked with him, and another angel in verse 3. And then in verse 4, the other angel said unto him, run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited, as towns without walls, for the multitude of men and cattle therein. So he says, Jerusalem is going to be inhabited like a town without walls. Now understand what walls were in that day. What were walls? Well, they were the protection of the city. They didn't have airplanes and helicopters. They didn't have missiles. Our technology makes walls kind of useless. But back then, since you just had to march up the city and march into it, a big, strong wall would keep the enemy invaders out. So it was their protection. It was their defense. So he says, Jerusalem is going to be inhabited like a city without defense. They don't need fortifications. They don't need walls. And it's not because nobody's there. There's a multitude of men and cattle in there. But why don't they need walls? He says, verse 5, for I, saith the Lord, will be unto her a wall of fire round about, and will be the glory in the midst of her. So no one would dare attack God's city. No one would dare mistreat the people there, because God is their protection. And he's not just around them protecting them, but he's also in the city, and he's their glory. He's their glory. He's the thing most significant. That's what your glory is the thing most significant about you. That's your glory. So the Lord will be the glory. Then in verses 6 through 9, the nations who have destroyed them, of course this is back in Zechariah's day, could also be the kingdom of God, but he says the nations who destroyed them, they're going to pay for it. He says, ho, ho, come forth and flee from the land of the north, saith the Lord, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heavens, saith the Lord. Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the daughter of Babylon. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you. For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. So he says, I'm going to take care of those nations who spoiled you. And then he talks about the glorious future of Israel, starting in verse 10. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion. For lo, I come, and I will dwell in the midst of thee, saith the Lord. I'll actually dwell among you, in the midst of you. Now that's not just Jesus Christ dwelling personally, because he can only be in one place. He's in the form of a man, right? But it'll be God through his Spirit will be dwelling in the midst of them all. The Spirit can dwell in all the cities and all the different places. So he says, and many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people, and I will dwell in the midst of thee. So he says, all the other nations are going to be coming and joining the kingdom, but where I'm actually going to place my presence most particularly is in the midst of you, Israel. And you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto thee. So that's talking about the kingdom of God. Well, then chapter 3 is mostly back to Zechariah's day. And the big thing is chapter 3 is this issue of Joshua the high priest. Here's this high priest. He's standing before the angel of the Lord, but he is wearing dirty garments. And I think that symbolizes he's been sinful. He has not been following the Lord like he should. And he's standing there. The angel of the Lord, who, of course, is the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, is on one side. Satan's on the other. Satan says, I want Joshua. You know, he looks like one of mine. He's got these dirty garments on. Christ doesn't let him have Joshua, and he says, clothe him with new garments. Put my garments on him. So he gets clothed. The Lord rescues him. He says he's like a brand I pulled out of the fire. He was about to get burned, but I yanked him out. I rescued him. And then he talks to Joshua in verse 6. The angel of the Lord protested unto Joshua, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, If thou wilt walk in my ways, and if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my courts, and I will give thee places to walk among these that stand by. So he says, I'll give you a place in the temple. Well, I don't think he's talking about back then, because he was already the high priest. What good would that be? But I think he's talking about in the kingdom of God. But then this is more than just Joshua, because verse 8 he says, Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at, for behold, I will bring forth my servant the branch. And so he jumps from this Joshua to another Joshua. Because I don't know if you realize this, but if you take the word Joshua, the name Joshua, that word comes to us from the Hebrew. And the Hebrew is Yeshua or Yehoshua. But if you take Yeshua and Yehoshua and turn it into Greek, it's Jesus. And if you take Jesus and turn it into English, it's Jesus. So the name Joshua from the Hebrew and the name Jesus from the Greek, they're the same name. It's just one were taken from Hebrew to English, one were taken from Hebrew to Greek to English. And they end up different ways when you do it that way. If you were to look at the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the book of Joshua is actually the book of Jesus, or Jesus, in the Septuagint. So this Joshua, this Jesus, the high priest, he says, there's going to be another Jesus. He's going to be my servant, the branch. So that's chapter 3. Now chapter 4 is again Zechariah's day. But it talks about something very interesting, and here's where we start getting into things that affect the tribulation. Because in verse 4 he said, And he said unto me, What seest thou? What do you see, Zechariah? And he says, And I said, I have looked, and behold, a candlestick all of gold, with a bowl upon the top of it, and the seven lamps thereon, and the seven pipes to the seven lamps, which are upon the top thereof, and two olive trees by it, one upon the right side of the bowl, and the other upon the left side thereof. So he sees a golden candlestick, and he sees two olive trees. Well, what's that all about? Verse 4, I answered and spake to the angel that talked with me, saying, What are these, my lord? He doesn't know what they are. Then the angel that talked with me answered and said unto me, Knowest thou not what these be? And I said, No, my lord. He answered and spake unto me, saying, This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. So he says, You don't know who these are? Well, talk to Zerubbabel. What is he going to say to Zerubbabel? Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain. And he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings, crying, Grace, grace unto it. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. And thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto you. So he says, Zerubbabel, it looks like you're facing a mountain. Why? Because Zerubbabel started the temple, he was building it away, he was serving the Lord, and the power of Persia came in and stopped him. And Persia was the world empire. And to try to go against Persia was going against the mountain. How could you do that? You couldn't. The mountain's too big. He says, that mountain is going to become a plain in front of you, Zerubbabel, and you're going to finish that temple that you started building. So verse 11, Then answered I and said unto him, What are these two olive trees upon the right side of the candlestick and upon the left side thereof? And I answered again and said unto him, What be these two olive branches which through the two golden pipes empty the golden oil out of themselves? And he answered me and said, Knowest thou not what these be? And I said, No, my lord. Then said he, These are the two anointed ones that stand by the Lord of the whole earth. Two anointed ones. Now we know that anointed means marked out by God for special service, right? Jesus Christ is the anointed one of God, but others can be anointed too. David was anointed, and Saul was anointed, the priests are anointed. So these are two anointed ones. Now, what's interesting about these two anointed ones? Who are they, first of all? Well, I think in context, who did he just talk about in chapter 3? He talked about Joshua. He's going to be God's high priest. Who did he talk about in chapter 4? He talked about Zerubbabel. He was the governor who was going to finish the building of the temple. So I think the two anointed ones he's talking about are the two people he just got done talking about, Joshua, the high priest, and Zerubbabel, the governor. But this is very interesting because did you ever notice in the book of Revelation, in chapter 11, talking about the tribulation and the day of the Lord, there are these two witnesses. In Revelation chapter 11, there are two witnesses. And in verse 4, it says of the two witnesses this. It says of these two witnesses, it says, these are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. So in the book of Zechariah, it calls Zerubbabel and Joshua candlesticks and olive trees. And in Revelation chapter 11, it calls the two witnesses candlesticks and olive trees. So could it be that the two witnesses of Revelation are Zerubbabel and Joshua, raised from the dead, living in the kingdom, that's going to be their job? Now, I'll admit I can't prove it 100%, but putting one passage with the other, I think there's more evidence for that than anything else. Well, very interesting. Zerubbabel and Joshua, olive branches and candlesticks. Two witnesses of Revelation, olive branches and candlesticks. Well, those are the early chapters. Now we get into the middle chapters. Now in the middle chapters, we start more introducing the idea of the tribulation and the kingdom of God, but we're still dealing with some events in the past here. We're not completely going, it's not like Daniel where you go through the first six chapters, their past, then you go through the last six chapters in their future. Zechariah kind of moves back and forth quite a bit before he finally ends up completely in the future. But in verse 5, or chapter 5, I should say, we get some very interesting things. It says, then I turned and lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, a flying roll. Or there would be a flying scroll, right? That's what they wrote on generally back then, were scrolls. It wasn't a book. They would roll them up. And he said unto me, what seest thou? And I answered, I see a flying roll. The length thereof is 20 cubits, and the breadth thereof 10 cubits. Now that's 30 feet long and 15 feet wide. That's a big scroll. It's a really big, you'd have trouble storing that in your closet. That's a big scroll. Then said he unto me, this is the curse that goeth forth over the face of the whole earth. For every one that stealeth shall be cut off as on this side according to it, and every one that sweareth shall be cut off as on that side according to it. So this scroll is written on both sides, and it's cutting off the wicked with a curse. And one side those who steal, and the other side those who swear falsely. Verse 4, and I will bring it forth, saith the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter into the house of the thief, and into the house of him that sweareth falsely by my name, and it shall remain in the midst of his house, and it shall consume it with the timber thereof and the stones thereof. So this scroll is about punishment on those who are being wicked. Now, that I can't help but be reminded of another scroll in the book of Revelation chapter 5. Same chapter of Revelation as we're in Zechariah. I don't think that's significant because human beings made the chapters. But Revelation chapter 5. And that introduces a scroll, right? A scroll with seven seals. But notice in Revelation 5:1, it says, and I saw on the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book. But again, that should be a scroll. They didn't have books when John was writing Revelation. They had scrolls. I saw a scroll written within and on the backside. Right, that's a scroll. That's not a book. Written inside and on the back, on both sides, sealed with seven seals. So the scroll with the seven seals is written on both sides. And you'll notice when he starts breaking those seals, punishments start happening. Could these be the same scroll? Maybe. Now, I can't prove it, but they definitely both have to do with punishment. They're both scrolls. They're both written on both sides. Could be the same thing. Could be the same thing. Well, then, back in Zechariah chapter 5 and verse 5, it says, "Then the angel that talked with me went forth and said unto me, Lift up now thine eyes and see what is this that goeth forth. And I said, What is it? And he said, This is an ephah that goeth forth. He said, Moreover, this is their resemblance through all the earth. So he sees an ephah. Now, an ephah, understand, was a unit of measurement. So you can't actually see a unit of measurement. So obviously this is some kind of basket or container that would hold an ephah. So it's a container that would hold an ephah. And behold, there is lifted up a talent of lead, and this is the woman that sitteth in the midst of the ephah. So there's a woman inside this ephah basket. And he said, This is wickedness. And he cast it into the midst of the ephah, and he cast the weight of lead upon the mouth thereof. Wouldn't you just like to do that? I just imagine him taking this woman, shoving her back in the basket, and pounding the lid on. Wouldn't you like it if you could actually do that with wickedness? But he does it. He shoves her back in, puts the lid on. Then I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, there came out two women, and the wind was in their wings, for they had wings like the wings of a stork. This is the only time in the Bible I see human figures where it has wings. And they're always trying to draw the angels with the wings. They're getting that from traditional old human ideas. This is the only time the cherubs have wings, right? But cherubs don't look like humans. They look pretty crazy. The heavenly beings that look like humans never have wings. But this one time we see humans with wings. So they have wings like a stork. So they're kind of like wings they like to put on angels. But they lifted up the ephah between the earth and the heaven. Then said I to the angel that talked with me, Whither do these bear the ephah? And he said unto me, To build it an house in the land of Shinar. And it shall be established and set there upon our own base. Well, what's the land of Shinar? Well, it's really the only other place it's mentioned is the book of Genesis, and there it refers to Babylon. Shinar is the old name for Babylon. Well, where do we see a center of wickedness set up in Babylon? We see it in Revelation, don't we? We see that Revelation, I mentioned Revelation 18, but certainly in that whole section, we see that Babylon becomes a center of wickedness, a center of especially religious wickedness and commercial wickedness in the tribulation period. So they're setting up a center of wickedness in Babylon. Well, by Zechariah's day, the Babylonian army empire had already fallen to the Persian Empire. So I think he's talking here about the tribulation period. Now then we have, in chapter 6, we have the chariots and the priest. It says, I turned and lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, there came four chariots out from between two mountains. And the mountains were mountains of brass. In the first chariot were red horses. And in the second chariot, black horses. And in the third chariot, white horses. And in the fourth chariot, grizzled and bay horses. Or that could be speckled and strong horses. So you have chariots with colored horses pulling them. Where else in the Bible do we see colored horses? Well, in Revelation, and coincidentally, chapter 6. Just like Zechariah chapter 6. Again, it's kind of a coincidence because God didn't make the chapters. But Revelation chapter 6, we see horses. In verse 2, there's a white horse. Then in verse 4, there's a red horse. And then there's a black horse in verse 5. And then the fourth horse there in Revelation is either pale or green. Depending, the word can be translated either way. But I wonder, we see colored horses. Could they be talking about maybe some of the same things in Zechariah and in Revelation? Well, of course, in this case, Revelation explains them a lot more than Zechariah does. Zechariah doesn't have a whole lot to say about them. But it seems to be talking maybe about the same thing. And then they go out in verses 4 through 8. And verse 6, the black horses which are therein go forth into the north country, and the white go forth after them. And I think about Christ at his second coming, that he comes back on a white horse. And I wonder, could it be the Antichrist who's pretending he's Christ? Could he be the one on the white horse? Well, I don't know. That's a question. Then in verses 9 through 15, he makes crowns and sets them on the head of Joshua the high priest and his companions. And he talks with them about the building of the temple in the past, yet also he talks about the branch again. And could it be that these men will be raised from the dead to have something to do with the building of the temple in the future as well? Well, I don't know for sure. Maybe, maybe not. Then we get to chapter 7, and chapter 7 is again mostly about Zechariah's day. What happens in chapter 7 we see in verses 1 through 3. It says, "And it came to pass in the fourth year of King Darius," so 2 years later, "that the word of the Lord came unto Zechariah in the fourth day of the ninth month, even in Chislew. When they had sent unto the house of God Sherezer and Regemmelech and their men to pray before the Lord and to speak unto the priests which were in the house of the Lord of hosts, and to the prophets, saying, Should I weep in the fifth month, separating myself, as I have done these so many years?" So what they're wondering about here is, remember, this is 70 years or so, a little more, after the destruction of Jerusalem. And when Jerusalem was destroyed and all the calamities they went through, there were days when this bad thing happened and then when this bad thing happened, and they had commemorated about five or so of those days with a fast. Every year since these calamities had happened to Jerusalem, on that day they would fast. And that was because they'd been carried away captivity and Jerusalem had been destroyed. But now, they're wondering, you know, we've come back. We're back in the land of Israel. We're back in Jerusalem. Should we keep doing the fasts? So they say, let's go ask the Lord's prophet. So they go to him, should we keep doing the fasts? Well, the Lord, he's not too excited about this question, because he seems more frustrated with them than their question is all about religion, right? The Lord kind of says, let's look at the heart here. Forget the religion. "Then came the word of the Lord of hosts unto me, saying, Speak unto all the people of the land and to the priests, saying, When you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month, even though 70 years, did ye at all fast unto me, even to me? When ye did eat and when ye did drink, did ye eat for yourselves and drink for yourselves? Did ye not eat for yourselves and drink for yourselves?" So he said, was it really about me that you are mourning? Were you really mourning because my city was destroyed, because my temple was destroyed? Or were you mourning for your own calamity and the calamity of your own people? So were these fasts really my fasts in the first place? Or was it just all about you and your own sorrows? And then he reminds them in verses 7 through 14, which I'm not going to read through. He's going to remind them, why did these calamities come on you? They weren't just random. They were because of your wickedness. They were punishment. And it was because of your wickedness, your oppression of the poor, and your refusal to hear my prophets when I'd send them to you again and again and again. But then he gives the good news, starting in chapter 8, and this, I think, 7 and 8 are both the same story. Because in 8 verse 2 he says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. Thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain." So he says, I'm going to come back to Jerusalem. I'm going to dwell in their midst. And they'll be known as the city of truth. They'll be known as the mountain of the Lord. Remember that mountains in the Bible, they symbolize governments. So he says, Jerusalem is going to be the center of my government. Then in verse 4 he says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age." Now, we could get a little bit confused there and wonder, well, does that mean that people will still be getting old and needing canes in the kingdom of God? Yeah. Well, I don't think so. But see, what's going on here, because he keeps going back and forth between Zechariah's day and the future. What's going on here is understand that when Babylon took all the inhabitants of Jerusalem out and of Judah out, what would happen to a land when you did that? Suppose that all of us who've come to America. If we, well, or our ancestors did way back. Suppose we all just left and went back to Europe. Or those from Asia went back there and those from Africa went back there and we all just abandoned it. What would happen to our cities, our highways, everything we've built here? It would very quickly start decaying and falling down and going back to how it was before we ever came. And that's what had happened to Israel, to Judah, as it sat empty for 70 years. So when they started to go back to Judah, it was almost like a pioneer movement going to an unsettled land. They weren't going back to a land where it was all nice and established. It was a pioneer movement. And one thing that's always true of pioneer movements is that it's largely young people who are doing it. The older people, they don't want to pack up and go to a new unsettled land. It's the young people. And the other thing about pioneer movements is that they're usually majority men, especially at first. The women follow later after the men have carved out, you know, something that the women can actually grab onto. But at first, it's mostly men, and it's mostly young people. What happens if it's all young people and mostly men? Well, there are very few children, and there are very few old people. So Jerusalem was being re-inhabited, but it was mostly men, and it was mostly young people, so you didn't have a lot of children, and that was why they had so much trouble wanting to marry women of the nations around them, because there weren't all that many Israelite women available. So you didn't have a lot of children, you didn't have a lot of old people, but God says, I'm going to carry this through. It's not going to stay like it is, a pioneer movement. There are going to be, you're going to see old men and old women in the streets again. It's not just going to be all young people. And you're going to see children in the streets again. There are going to be marriages and children, and there are going to be little children playing, not just all people in their 20s and 30s or whatever are coming in the pioneer movement. So he's not talking about the kingdom of God, that people are still getting old and need canes in the kingdom. He's talking about, in verse 5, the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof. Well, you didn't see that in this frontier towns full of young men. You didn't see boys and girls playing in the streets. But he says it's going to happen. So, verses 7 through 8, Israel, they're going to return to their land from the east. They're going to dwell in Jerusalem. They're going to be his people. Could be in the immediate future and further out in the kingdom too. Verses 9 through 11, thus saith the Lord of hosts, let your hands be strong, you that hear in these days these words by the mouth of the prophets, which were in the day that the foundation of the house of the Lord of hosts was laid, that the temple might be built. For before these days there was no hire for man, nor any hire for beast, neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the affliction. For I set all men, every one, against his neighbor. But now I will not be unto the residue of this people as in the former days, saith the Lord of hosts. So he says, I'm going to fix things up. It's all going to be well for you again. And he calls on them to remember, to think about these days. And then in verses 12 through 17, he calls on them to remember these things, to speak truth to their neighbors and not imagine evil to their neighbors. And then he gets back to the fast. He finally gets back to the fast. Verse 18. Then the word of the Lord of hosts came unto me, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth, and the fast of the seventh, and the fast of the tenth. These were all the days when the calamity had been happening. And they turn them all into fasts. Well, he says, these shall be to the house of Judah joy and gladness and cheerful feasts. Therefore, love the truth and peace. So he says, these days that were days of mourning for you, that were days of sadness, here's the good news. Once everything is restored, once you're in the kingdom, once all those sorrows are wiped away, those days aren't going to be mourning days. They aren't going to be fasting days. They're going to be feasts and joy. Why? Well, I think it'll be just like when Christ died and was buried in the tomb. And his disciples were mourning. They were in sorrow. I don't think they didn't know if they were coming or going. They barely knew what they were doing. They were just, it wiped them out that their Lord, they knew he was the Messiah. Most of them even knew he was the Son of God, at least the 12 did. And now he's dead. How can this be? They're wiped out. They're so full of sorrow. And yet what happens when he rises from the dead? That sorrow turns to joy. And I don't think they forgot about the sorrow. They could think back to the sorrow, but could the sorrow touch them? Would they start crying for that sorrow again? Would it make them feel sad again? No. Because they couldn't remember that sorrow anymore without remembering the joy that followed it. And the Lord said, when I really restore Jerusalem, when I bring it into the kingdom, when I take all these sorrows and reverse them, you won't be able to sorrow when you remember them anymore. All you'll be able to do is rejoice, because you'll see how I've turned it all around. Now in chapter 9, he takes a brief section where he prophesies about other nations. He prophesies about the destruction of Tyre and Philistia. And I think that was Mr. Sellers never got to teaching book of Zechariah in his audios. But in Ezekiel, he teaches about the destruction of Tyre under Alexander the Great in the Greek Empire. And I think that this is probably talking about that destruction of Tyre as well. But then in verse 8, he talks again about his protection of Israel and the kingdom. When he says, I will encamp about mine house because of the army, because of him that passeth by, and because of him that returneth, and no oppressor shall pass through them any more. For now have I seen with mine eyes. So he says, I'm going to take care of Judah, and when the time comes, nobody is going to pass through them to oppress them anymore. Now he jumps, he's jumping all over. Now he jumps to the triumphal entry of Christ that's already taken place for us in the past. Of course, for Zechariah, it was 100 years in the future. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt the foal of an ass. So there you have the triumphal entry. Then in verse 10, he talks about bringing peace to the kingdom, in the kingdom. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the nations. And his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends, the most remote places of the earth. So he's going to bring peace in the kingdom. And then in verses 11 through 17, he talks about rescuing them from the oppression of Greece. Now, chapter 10, which is the last chapter that I call of these middle chapters, has to do again with the prophecies of the kingdom. Verses 1 through 5, he talks about saving them from their enemies. In verses 6 through 12, he prophesies Israel's return to the land from the captivity in the kingdom. So that closes out the middle chapters. Well, then we get to the latter chapters, which are all about the tribulation period. Tribulation period. So at this point, I think he pretty much stops bouncing back and forth from his day to the future day and just is going to stay in the tribulation throughout. Now, chapter 11, I believe, is talking about Jerusalem in rebellion, talking about bands broken and the worthless shepherd. So in 11, verse 1, he says, open thy doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour thy cedars. Howl, fir tree, for the cedar is fallen, because the mighty are spoiled. So as often happens in the Bible, cedars and firs, these great trees, stand for the great ones among men, the leaders, the rulers, right? They're being cut down. Howl, O ye oaks of Bashan, for the forest of the vintage is cut down. There is a voice of the howling of the shepherds. Again, shepherds were always symbolic in Israel for the rulers, because they were shepherding the sheep, the common people. For their glory is spoiled, a voice of the roaring of young lions, for the pride of Jordan is spoiled. Now what's going on? Well, I think he's talking about Jerusalem, the city, in the tribulation period, and he's talking about it after the righteous rulers in God's kingdom have fled to the mountains. Right, we know that there's that prophecy in Daniel, and the Lord talks about Matthew 24, that all his people are to flee to the mountains. So who's left in Jerusalem? Well, a lot of rebels are left in Jerusalem. So Jerusalem, the city during the tribulation, is bad news. Is bad news. Now he sets up a kind of a parable with Zechariah. Kind of a mysterious thing, but I think it's talking about Jerusalem, the city, the rebellious city in the tribulation. He says, thus saith the Lord my God, feed the flock of the slaughter. So he says, I want you to become a shepherd for a flock where their owners have already decided these sheep are going to be slaughtered for meat. Their owners have already sold them to death, and you're going to be taking care of them before this flock set aside for slaughter. Well, that's going to symbolize the common people of Israel at this time, because the rebellious leaders who have joined Satan's side in the tribulation, they're selling out the common people. Well, what would you expect those who have joined Satan's side to do? He says, whose possessors slay them and hold themselves not guilty. And they that sell them say, blessed be the Lord, for I am rich. And their own shepherds pity them not. So they have no pity for the sheep. They say, hey, I can get money by selling these guys out. Praise the Lord. I'll do it. Imagine that, praising the Lord that you just sold people out for money. Well, that's what they're doing. Well, of course, it's one thing to sell sheep for money. It's another thing to sell people, which I think is what the parable is symbolizing. For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord. But lo, I will deliver the men every one into his neighbor's hand and into the hand of his king. And they shall smite the land, and out of their hand I will not deliver them. And I will feed the flock of slaughter, even you, O poor of the flock. And I took unto me two sticks, shepherd's stick. And Bullinger suggests he has his staff that he uses to help and rescue the sheep, and then he has his club that he uses against the enemies of the sheep. So one is beauty and the other is bands. And he says, I fed the flock. Three shepherds also I cut off in 1 month. He fired three shepherds. My soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred me. So there's a lot of upheaval and turnover in the rulers here. Then said I will not feed you. That that dieth, let it die. That that is to be cut off, let it be cut off. And let the rest eat every one the flesh of another. So he says, I'm just lifting my hands up. Whatever happens to the flock can happen to them. I'm not going to take care of them if they starve, if they eat each other, if the wolves carry them away, whatever. I took my staff, even beauty, and cut it asunder, that I may break my covenant which I had made with all the people. So he says, I just break my covenant. And it was broken in that day, and so the poor of the flock that waited upon me knew that it was the word of the Lord. And I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. It's a very interesting number, isn't it? They sold off God's shepherd. They fired the Lord's shepherd, gave him 30 pieces of silver to get rid of him. Very interesting. A shepherd sold out for 30 pieces of silver. Well, the Lord said to me, cast it onto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized out of them. I think there's some sarcasm there. Oh, that was a nice price to sell out the Lord for, 30 pieces of silver. So they took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I may break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. See, now here's a big thing where I think this has to be the tribulation period. Why? Because Judah and Israel were broken, and for the most part, they were never at least fully re-restored and reintegrated. In some ways they were. They're going to be completely in the kingdom. But when was there, to the extent that they were reintegrated, when was that ever broken again? Never in the past. If they were reintegrated, some from all the tribes came back to the land. That was never broken again. But among these rebellious in the tribulation period, that division is going to spring up again. And the Lord said unto me, take unto thee yet the instruments of a foolish shepherd. For lo, I will raise up a shepherd in the land which shall not visit those that be cut off. Neither shall seek the young one, nor heal that that is broken, nor feed that that standeth still. But he shall eat the flesh of the fat and tear their claws in pieces. So instead of caring for the people, he's going to just benefit himself and doesn't care who he tears up of the people. Woe to the idle shepherd that leaves the flock. The sword shall be upon his arm and upon his right eye. His arm shall be clean dried up, and his right eye shall be utterly darkened. So I think that the worthless shepherd there, the shepherd that he sets up over them, is probably that man of sin, who is the final most wicked ruler in the tribulation period. But now we're going to switch scenes. We're still going to be talking about Jerusalem, but a very different looking Jerusalem. Chapter 12 and verse 1. It says, the burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens, and layeth the foundation of the earth, and formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. So now we have all the people of the earth gathered together against Jerusalem. Now what Jerusalem is this? Well, understand, when you talk about a city, you can talk about two things. And we can see this commonly in the Bible too. You can talk about the actual location of the city itself with the buildings and everything. Or you can talk about the inhabitants of the city. That's why sometimes God will talk to Jerusalem, to Zion, and say, talk about your father was an Amorite, your mother was a Hittite or something. I'm not sure that I'm getting that exactly right. But he's talking about Jerusalem, the city, the location. Because before Israel came in and inhabited Jerusalem, it was inhabited by Canaanite nations, right? Yeah. So when he says, you know, your history was with these peoples, well, he's talking about the location, the city. But then if he talks to them and he says, I brought you out of Egypt. Well, he didn't bring Jerusalem, the city, out of Egypt. He brought the inhabitants out of Egypt. Right? So in the tribulation, after God's inhabitants of Jerusalem have fled to the mountains, you're going to have Jerusalem, the city, full of wicked rebels and wickedness and God's wrath on them. And then you're going to have Jerusalem, the people. They're going to be out in the mountains. God's going to be taking care of them. This Jerusalem is under God's wrath, his punishment. This Jerusalem is under God's protection. He's pleased with them. So chapter 11 is talking about Jerusalem, the city, full of rebels. Chapter 12 is talking about Jerusalem, the people, the faithful, his rulers, who he's taking care of. And he says these people are going to be, they're going to be burdensome to the rest of the people of the earth. They're going to say, we just can't be happy as long as these people are still there and still alive. Yeah, it's nice that we exiled them, kicked them out of their city, but it just bothers us that they're still alive. We want to wipe these people out. They're just too burdensome to keep around, these reminders of God and his government. We got to get rid of them. So they come against them, but all the people who come against them, he says, are going to be cut in pieces. Verse 4, in that day, saith the Lord, I will smite every horse with astonishment, and his rider with madness. And I'll open mine eyes upon the house of Judah, and will smite every horse of the people with blindness. So he says, I'm going to strike the horses and their riders with madness and with blindness. I'm going to strike the people who come against Jerusalem. Verse 5, he says, and the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength in the Lord of hosts, their God. Well, remember that Judah is the governing province, and Jerusalem is the governing city. So the top rulers are all from Jerusalem, and they're relying on the rulers that God has given them. Well, that's good. They should rely on the rulers God has given them. Verse 6, in that day will I make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood, and like a torch of fire in a sheaf. And they shall devour all the people round about, on the right hand and on the left. And then notice what it says. Here's what I was just telling you. And Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. So he says, after I cut off all their enemies, Jerusalem is going to live in Jerusalem again. Well, see, the first Jerusalem is Jerusalem, the people who've been exiled to the mountains. But now they're going to move back and live in Jerusalem, the city, again, because their enemies have been cut off. So two Jerusalems, the place and the people. Verse 7, the Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. So this has something to do with how he does it. I don't exactly know what it means, but apparently Judah is going to get glory too. Not just Jerusalem, not just David's house, but all the rulers from Judah are going to get glory. Now he says more about what he's going to do for them. Verse 8, in that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble, he that is weak among them at that day shall be as David. And the house of David shall be as God, as the angel of the Lord before them. So he says, I'm going to empower. He's basically going to empower them against their enemies and make them super soldiers. So he says, the weakest, the feeblest among them will be like David. Now, what was David like in the past? Well, he was a warrior. He was a mighty warrior. He says, I bent a bow of steel. I leaped over a wall. He doesn't say how high it was, but I imagine it wasn't just a couple inches for him to brag about it, right? It's probably a pretty high wall. God gave him the power to jump over. So he was a mighty warrior. He says, the weakest of them will be like David. Well, what would David and his house be like then? Well, they would be like God, like the angel of the Lord. They'd be like Christ himself. I don't know. I suppose if Christ really went to battle, he'd be pretty good. And he says, these guys are going to be like Christ himself. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. So he's going to destroy them. Then verse 10, and I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. So here they look upon Christ. So when he comes to rescue them, that's his coming for his parousia, right? It's what we typically call the second coming. Well, parousia doesn't really mean coming, but it starts with him coming to earth. It's just too bad they translated parousia as coming. But he's going to have come, and they're going to look on him. They're going to have mourned for him. Now, this is one verse people try to use to try to disprove the premillennial kingdom. Because they like to say, well, Israel is going to see Christ and they're going to mourn. Why are they mourning? They can say, well, it's got to be because Israel's rejected Christ down through these years. So when they see him, they realize, oh man, we were wrong. And they're going to mourn that they were wrong about Christ. Well, I think Israel is going to mourn when they realize they're wrong about Christ. But I think that's going to happen way back here, not at the end of the tribulation. But the thing is, they act like that's the only reason you could ever mourn for Christ. But I don't think that's the only reason you could ever mourn for Christ. What is the tribulation really going to be about? When we understand that it's after the kingdom, what's it going to be about? It's a testing, to test the hearts of people. The hearts of them. And what's really going to be going on in the hearts of those who, after having seen God's kingdom and seen how glorious he is, rebel against him? What's going on in their hearts? Well, they are hating Jesus Christ. This isn't just about that they don't like the kingdom. It's about that they don't like the king of the kingdom. Because the kingdom is him. It's set up according to him. It's all about him. All the rules, everything the way it works on earth. Just like now it's all about Satan. Then it's going to be all about Christ. And so they're going to have rebelled because they hated him. And so these people, after they've gone through this rebellion, after they've seen his enemies wiped out, and then they see him. They see this glorious Lord, and they think, he's the one it was all about? This one who is so great, who's so gracious, who's so good. They hated him enough to do all these things they've done in the tribulation. And it's just going to cause them to mourn. To mourn. How could anyone hate someone like Jesus Christ? How could anyone join Satan's side instead of his? And they're going to mourn. So that's why I think they're mourning. Not because, oh, I just realized for the first time that Jesus was the Messiah, not somebody else. No, I don't think that's why they're mourning. Well, now, chapter 13, we start to get into the earth being restored after what takes place in the rebellion. It says, in that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. So here we have a fountain, water flowing out in the 1,000 years. Now, Andy had quoted in his talk yesterday about that there's going to be this river flowing out from Jerusalem in the kingdom of God. And lo and behold, there's also a fountain flowing with water in the 1,000 years. So the same thing. God's going to be flowing out in the 1,000 years just like he did in the kingdom. And then in verse 2, he starts to get rid of all these things that the wicked people have brought back in the tribulation. See, as I study the tribulation, I get the idea that the people there are trying to restore what it was like before the kingdom. That's what the rebels are trying to do. And I think they're reading the Bible to try to figure out, because the Bible will still be there, right? They're trying to figure out what the earth was like before the kingdom from the Bible. And, you know, they don't read about Buddhism or Confucianism or, you know, atheism. Or they read about idols. So they say, oh, they worshiped idols, let's do those. And so forth. So they're trying to restore all these things. So they restore idols. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. And I will also cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land. Well, remember Christ talks about the tribulation. He says there are going to be false prophets and false messiahs. So he says, I'm going to cut all those off. I'm going to get rid of all of them. And it shall come to pass that when any shall yet prophesy, then his father and his mother that begat him shall say unto him, Thou shalt not live, for thou speakest lies in the name of the Lord. And his father and his mother that begat him shall thrust him through when he prophesieth. So even those closest to him wouldn't dare join with him. They would rather kill him when they find he's a false prophet. And it shall come to pass in that day that the prophet shall be ashamed every one of his vision when he hath prophesied, neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive. So they've been going around and pretend holy men often do, going around in rough garments so they look like a prophet, look like John the Baptist or something. They've been trying to fake it with a rough garment. They're not going to do that anymore. He's going to say, I am no prophet. I'm a husbandman. I'm a farmer. For man taught me to keep cattle from my youth. All I really know how to do is keep cows. I don't know anything about being a prophet. I was just pretending. And one shall say unto him, What are these wounds in thine hands? Then he shall answer, Those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. Now, a lot of people try to apply this to Christ, but I think that's because they don't realize that in the tribulation, the Jews will realize that Jesus is the Christ. They're trying to put the tribulation here, and the Jews still not admitting Jesus is Christ. But see, after we've gone through all these years of the premillennial kingdom, everybody's going to know that Jesus is Christ. And so nobody can be a false Christ without marks in his hands. So if they're going to be false Christ in the tribulation, they say, I'm going to pretend to be Christ. How can I do it? Well, I have to have the marks in my hands. So they go to the house of a friend, and they fake the marks. They fake the marks. So now these guys are coming up to him and saying, wait a minute. I thought you were Christ. If you're not Christ, where do those marks in your hands come from? And they're admitting it themselves. They're saying, I was just in the house of my friends and gave those marks to myself. Now, here we start moving in history a little bit again. Because now he kind of goes back to review for us, well, why would a false Christ be putting marks in his hands? Why would he be doing that? Well, because the real one has marks in his hands. So that's what he talks about in verse 7. He says, Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow. There's no other than Jesus Christ that God could say, this man is my fellow. He's my equal. There's a man who's my equal. How can a man be equal with God? Well, he can't, but God can become a man, right? And then that man is equal with God, and that's what Christ is. So the sword awakes against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. Of course, in the New Testament, that's applied to the disciples, how they scattered when Christ was smitten. Then in verse 8 it says, And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, It is my people, and they shall say, The Lord is my God. So here he talks about the purifying of his people. And the question I have then is, what is he talking about? Is he talking about the tribulation period, or is he talking about the start of the kingdom? Because we did jump back in verse 7. And I tend to place this in at the start of the premillennial kingdom. I think that he's saying that when he gathers Israel back, that ultimately about a third, and we're talking Israel all through history, from Abraham down to the generation that will be alive when the kingdom starts, that a third of them he's going to refine and make his own, and two-thirds of them are wicked and going to be cut off. Now, I don't really have a lot of evidence to say it's here other than there, except that I really, really hope that after going through the kingdom, that more of Israel will pass the tribulation test than a third. Yeah. I really hope it's a lot more than a third. So, I'm optimistic that it will be. I don't think God's kingdom will only get to a third. So that's why I put it here. But I'll admit, it could be either place. But I would like to think it's here because I would like to think more than a third pass the tribulation test. chapter 14. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. So Jerusalem is spoiled in the day of the Lord. Well, no, I think he's dividing the spoil of their enemies. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. So Jerusalem is actually, by Satan's forces, is actually attacked and beaten, and people carried into captivity again. See, there's a captivity again in the tribulation period. There's another captivity. Well, of course, the Lord will reverse that when it's all over. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. Well, he ascended from the Mount of Olives. When he comes back, it's going to be to the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a very great valley. And half of the mountain shall remove toward the north and half of it toward the south. And ye, that would be the righteous inhabitants of Jerusalem who are being chased by the nations, they'll flee to the valley of the mountains, this new valley. For the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azal. Yea, ye shall flee like ye fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah king of Judah. And the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee. So the Lord comes to rescue them. So this is what we call the second coming. Now, the Bible doesn't call it that, but that's what we think of it as. So it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. So it sounds like it's actually evening when the Lord comes, but his coming is so bright that it's light like the day. And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half of them toward the hinder sea, half of them toward the Mediterranean west, and half of them toward the Dead Sea east. In summer and in winter shall it be. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. And in that day there shall be one Lord, and his name one. So it results in his parousia, his thousand-year reign from earth. But then he talks about, in verse 12, this shall be the plague wherewith the Lord will smite all the people that have fought against Jerusalem. So now we go back to the battle again. And he said, oh yeah, I'm not just going to strike them with madness. I'm not just going to empower my people to be super soldiers. I'm also going to smite them with a plague. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand on their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouth. So the battle, some people like to call this the Battle of Armageddon. Well, it's not at Armageddon. It's in this new valley between the Mount of Olives. But also, it's not really a battle. It's more like a slaughter. The enemy are going mad, striking each other down. The Lord striking them with a plague. His people are all super soldiers. It's not a battle. He's wiping out his enemies. And Judah shall fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the nations round about shall be gathered together, gold and silver and apparel in abundance. So this is the plague upon them. And then he brings all the nations back. He says, you have to come back to the Feast of Tabernacles. So he's gathering them back to himself. And everyone which came up to Jerusalem shall go from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. It shall be whoso will not come up of all the families of the earth to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even upon him shall be no rain. So he's bringing them back into the kingdom and says, if you don't come, there won't be rain. And then he explains, nations that don't rely on rain, like Egypt, will smite with a plague instead. Then verse 20, in that day shall there be on the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord. And the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. Even the most common articles will be holy to the Lord. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seethe therein. And in that day there shall no more be the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. In other words, they'll not be defiled by any unrighteous person again. So the book of Zechariah teaches some great things about the prophet's day, some things about the kingdom of come, but especially has some things to say about that great tribulation period and about the battle coming at the end of it and the coming of Christ for his parousia. So that day ends in ultimate victory for the Lord and his forces, and he does indeed win in the end. Praise God.